This is Fam Electric Ghost, and we're live on air with Alex McVeigh. Or Vay? McVeigh, right? Your name is Alex McVeigh. I got it right?
It's Alice like Wonderland. McVeigh, yeah.
McVeigh. And we have you for the first time on the podcast, and we always have to mention this podcast is on Newsly. It's an iOS app, so if you use the coupon code GHOST and get 1 month free premium subscription, this podcast will be on Newsly, so you can stop scrolling and start listening. Use that coupon code and get 1 month free. So we love to have new people on the program all the time. Welcome to the show. How are you doing today?
I'm okay. I've had a cold, so I hope I don't start coughing. Other than that, I'm absolutely great.
So I always ask people about like how they got into what they do, and you're an author. And you're a London-based ghostwriter. You have two contemporary novels published by Ryan Hatchett and an award-winning dystopian thriller published by the UK's Unbound. So maybe you want to talk about how did you first get into writing? Can you?
Yeah, I can remember. I can remember really well. I had a strange childhood, but it was good. My dad was an American diplomat. My parents met in the CIA. And then my dad went into the Foreign Service, State Department. And I was born in South Korea. Can't remember anything about it. Then we moved to Bangkok. And I remember a snake that almost killed me on the driveway.
Oh, wow.
I was driving my tricycle. Yeah, so that was quite amusing. And then we moved to Singapore, which I loved. I was eight and a bit of nine in Singapore. And I just, that was the happiest time. Well, actually Burma was as well, Myanmar. And we finished up in Myanmar. And all of that time we had this huge advantage and big disadvantage, which is, this is my sister and me, she's 1 year younger, which is that we didn't have any English language TV. So that was an advantage and a disadvantage. We were out of cultural step with America in a way. And believe me, people got excited when there was a film, like a Disney film that came in that we could all watch. Yeah. At the embassy. It was just like so exciting. But the other thing is that we, because we didn't have TV, what we did was we did two things. We read all the time. My sister and I, we were just complete bookworms. And she's an editor and I'm an author. But we also listened to music. And my father was very, very passionate about music. He died last year. And he used to play classical music to us. So every night we'd sort of all gather around reading our books and listening to classical music. So as I say, it was lucky and unlucky. We missed out on some things, but we gained in other ways. And I think I was always a writer because I would make up stories for my sister from the stuff that we were reading together. And I also became a cello player. I'm a professional cellist in London because of listening to the classical music. So I'm in fact, next Saturday, I'm quite excited about this. I'm playing the Elgar Cello Concerto with an orchestra in London. So at the moment, I feel more as if I've got my cellist hat on. But in fact, these days, I have to be honest, the days when I used to play with the BBC Symphony are kind of past. That was 10 years ago. I was doing that regularly. Now I'm much more of an author, and that's pretty much what I do. You can see my cello in the background, though.
Yeah.
And as I say, at the moment, I'm really well in practice because I'm doing the yoga. So, so I have advantage and disadvantages growing up in Asia. I was still very American. You can hear it in my voice. I'm still American, you know. But at the same time, I'm half-half because I've got a British accent. A little bit of a British accent, and I have a British husband, and my daughter's British, so I'm kind of confused.
That's very interesting, because I spent, my daughter, she went to preschool and kindergarten in Tokyo.
I knew that. I listened to one of your podcasts. You were there for 2 years, and you absolutely adore Japan. Yeah.
Yeah, it was just the whole experience was really cool, because, you know, she ended up with the kind of situation where there was no, like, English TV. It really influenced her art to this day. She's 23 and she's got this like Shinto mysticism, like an Asian influence to her work. She's actually got picked to be in a basically what they call it, sort of residency for an artist. She's doing a residency online. She does work with the disabled artist, trying to push like the fact that disabled artists should be able to get into galleries, they should be able to do their work. And she's actually an art mm-hmm. art like management into like it's like a
isn't that amazing what came out of 2 years in Japan that it influenced her art for the rest of her life possibly. That's pretty amazing. Just,
I think travel is so important, and a lot of Americans we don't know multiple languages. We don't travel. Maybe we go to Bermuda or Barbados.
Well, it's funny because my daughter is 2 years older than yours, and she's doing a master's in Beijing at Peking University in Chinese literature. And she's fluent in Chinese, Japanese, a bit of Korean. She blows my tiny mind because I'm sitting here like, I can't even do French. I go, je ne sais quoi. You know? but she does blow my tiny mind because she is so good at languages. And I'm very proud of her because, I mean, as you say, she's not your average British or American kid. She's been places and done things that is really brave, I think. And,
well, yeah, having that global impact,
it
really must have helped you because it widens your imagination, because then you have a more global experience. You know, it just, for me, it just made me less risk averse to doing like experimental work, because like I'm willing to go here. Why won't I be willing to work on other things? So you, started to write, did you originally write short stories or try to go right to the novel form? And
I wrote really bad poetry. I wrote terrible poetry. I still got some of my terrible poetry. Oh my God, it is so bad. It is embarrassing. But then I got into short stories. And then when I was 12, which is fairly precocious, I wrote my first novel, and that was terrible too. Oh my God, it was so bad. I still have this terrible novel I wrote when I was 12. And I wrote it when I was living in Singapore and then a bit in Burma. And I have a sister, as I mentioned, and we're very close. And I showed it only to my sister, and she wrote, "This is just yucky." And she was right. She's my younger sister, which made it worse. But anyway, the thing is that no, she was quite right. I was trying to go above my pay grade. I was thinking I could already write a novel.
Your mic kind of is having a problem. You got a little distorted on your mic.
All right. I don't know why. Can you hear me now?
Try it again.
Right. I was just saying I'd written this terrible novel when I was 12. I can't hear it now.
Yeah, it's a little fuzzy, but maybe it's going to get better. I don't know what happened, but maybe the signal, okay. The Wi-Fi or something.
It could have been the signal. We've got pretty good Wi-Fi here, but I'll tuck that in. Anyway, yeah, so my sister, as I say, wound up to be an editor, which my mother also was. My father was a biographer. That's really where his heart lay. He was a diplomat by profession, but in his heart, he was just a writer. So I kind of got it from him. But yeah, so then after that, I got a bit obsessed with the cello. And I just played cello. And I was really a little bit mad about the cello. And then I went to Jacob's School, Indiana University School of Music, to play cello. And I got my degree there. But I didn't want to stay in America. It's sort of like what we were talking about just now. I wanted to go abroad. And because my languages are so bad, I could have studied with a guy in Germany, but he taught in German. And I was scared of German because my German is really terrible. I don't really have any German. So in the end, I applied to study with Jacqueline Dupré, the cellist, the famous British cellist. And she accepted me. And I was so happy. I've never been happier my entire life than when she accepted me. And so I came over to Britain for 1 year and I met my husband and I overstayed my visa. I overstayed it by about a month. I was so naive. Anyway, so we went to the visa place and they said, "It's okay, no problem at all. We're just going to fine you a huge amount unless you get married in the next 3 months." And so my husband goes, "Do you want to get married?" And I'm going, "Okie dokie." So it was not like a good deep decision, really. So I just thought if I let this guy get out of my life, he might have been the right one. And then I might regret it for my whole life. So my mother was appalled. She said, "We've never had a divorce in the family." And I said, "Well, I don't think you will now, but I'm going to stick around and find out." So I stayed and I've been here for over 30 years. And now I'm halfway British and halfway American and halfway cellist and halfway author.
Well, I think if you can hear me. Okay. One of the things I think is really interesting as artists is like when you're multifaceted, you're a musician and an author, do you find that the music and the writing kind of co-mingle in terms of your inspiration? Does it help you? to be able to have one and the other to maybe degree able to go, take a break from one and go to the next one to give yourself like some room.
Absolutely. I cannot agree more. You obviously know exactly what it feels like. You're the same. I had a big breakthrough. I was playing with various London orchestras, but I was feeling quite unhappy because I was infertile. I couldn't have my kid. I wrote a book. This was a good novel. It's called While the Music Lasts. It's available now on my website. But then it was bought by a big five publisher, While the Music Lasts. And it's all about life behind the scenes of a symphony orchestra. So what I did was I took my life behind the scenes in a symphony orchestra, and I changed all the names and I changed all the characters, and I just wrote a novel about it. And I was so fortunate to get it bought by Orion. So that's now available only for me because it got out of print with Orion. But that was sort of a massive breakthrough because I thought, right, I can do something that's just for me, not just a conductor telling me what to do. And that was massive. And so my whole life had sort of been writer, cellist, and infertile. And suddenly, last second, we had 7 test tube treatments, and the very last one worked.
Oh wow!
And that's great. It was like a miracle.
Yeah, that's amazing. To be able to have something like that happen, because it's like in my life, you know, like I was hit with cancer 27, which was like a big. That's how I ended up meeting my wife and I ended up going to Japan, because I felt like after I survived it, it made me more willing to take risks and to actually be more true to what I wanted to do. So sometimes there's something that happens to you, like maybe with your health or something, and then you get past it. And it really, or it helps you, like, you know, express yourself or become more of you. You become you. It's like you actualize yourself.
In a way, my music career fed into my first two novels because it was all about the music profession. But after that, I sort of broke away from it. And I thought, well, I actually had this weird experience when I was having an energy healing. I was in a sort of joint meditation with my energy healer. And I got this sort of vision. And the vision was of a young man, half Indigenous, Australian. And he was all bound up in this chair, a steel chair. And I was looking down at him from the surface of the earth, about 100 feet or yards even down. And I couldn't get this guy out of my head. And I came home and I said to my husband, I think I'm going to write a science fiction novel. He said, you couldn't write science fiction. I said, watch me. So I did. I wrote a science fiction book, and that one got bought by Unbound, and it's called Last Star Standing. And it's all narrated by this guy who's slightly crazy, slightly out there, and nothing like anything I've ever written before. And then what happened? Well, that went really well. That was only last year. No, it wasn't. It was, 2021. And then I recollected that I'd written a book that was very like Jane Austen's kind of books. And I thought, right, this book's doing really well. I'll shove that one out and see what happens. And I actually got three really publishers. One of them wasn't a very good publisher though. The other two were proper publishers. They were excellent. And I turned them down because I thought, I actually want to do what my friends have been doing and put it out myself and take full responsibility and have all the decisions on me. And so that's these two. And they're Jane Austen-esque. And those have done really well too. As a matter of fact, this one has won 7 awards. So at the moment, I don't know what I'm writing. I'm writing a third one of that. And after that, I may go back to the orchestra or I may do a sequel to the science fiction. I don't know.
But I think that's really interesting about going into the self-publishing, because a lot of musicians, we've converted into independent work because the whole industry has got shifted so much since Napster and streaming that in order to take control of our work and to get licensing deals that are better, we tend to go independent, because a lot of times, unless you're a big you know superstar, the labels don't really help you like they used to. So
they don't.
Yeah, you found
and
the
also,
same thing.
And also, you got to do all the marketing anyway. When I was published by Orion, they just said, leave it to us, kid, and we're going to promote your book. And that was just great. But these days, I have a friend who's published by Tor, who is the science fiction publisher in the world. And he still has to do all of his own marketing, just as if he was self-publishing. They don't, they really, really, really leave it to the author these days, even the mega people. So you're not really gaining them much. And then they take a higher percentage of the royalties. So I thought, I'm not going to have that happen to me again. I'm just going to do it on my own. And it's been an adventure and it's been really fun. And sometimes it's been really frustrating, but I'm really glad I did it. It's mine.
Yeah, so. I think it's better to control your work. Oh, I find, at least the type of work I like to do. Like, if I would left it to the label, I couldn't do the experimental stuff I'm doing. They would try to make me do like something else, and then at the end, a lot of times I was on a couple labels, and they said they were going to do X and Y, and I ended up still doing all the work that I normally do. And I'm like, and I found the same kind of situation. I was like, what's the point of that?
So, it's true. And also, I think with COVID, everything is so much in flux now anyway. COVID has changed a lot and tech has changed a lot. And I just think that most industries are kind of shifting at the moment.
Well, I think it's better when you have ownership of your work, you know, because if you can, if you're responsible. If you make a mistake, yeah, you're responsible. But I think the whole thing about at least the content, I'm such an experimental artist, and I don't know what happens in the writing industry, but they might not like agree with your pitch, but agree with your topic and want you to, and not want to market it. And then at least if it's something you believe in, you're putting your energy into it. Like you don't feel like they've been restricting your output or something, you know?
It's interesting. You're experimental. I think I know a couple of experimental friends of mine who write fiction. That's experimental, and it is harder to place and it's harder to sell sometimes. And I think that scares a lot of people off, which is such a shame.
Yeah. Such a shame. So like in terms of like how you found the type of work you like to write about, how did you like get into that, the topics, like the Jane Austen type of stories? Was that just because you were a big fan or a reader of that type of style?
Yes, it was partly what drew me to Britain, I think, was I was always very keen on Jane Austen. And then when I came to Britain in those days, I mean, we're talking the 80s now, it was still very old fashioned. It wasn't so crowded. It was still incredibly green. I went to these stately homes and I just felt completely into the whole vibe of the history bit. And this was long before Bridgerton, but there was still some really good series, still some really good films that fired my imagination. And what I thought was, what I'd like to do is to explore combining her characters. So taking characters from Pride and Prejudice, from Emma, and making them collide in London, and then different things happening. So I just got inspired by that idea. And then when it started winning awards, I was just going, whoa, this is really good. So my science fiction book didn't actually win anything, but it was a finalist in a few. That was very experimental because what I did then was it was all narrated from his point of view. And that was considered pretty daring because for the first third of the book, he was just tied up in this chair, wasn't he? He was just tied up in the chair. What he was doing was he was... recollecting what happened with his previous girlfriend, what happened with the girlfriend before that, and all these missions he was on where he wound up assassinating people. So basically it was a mixture of romance and action. Kirkus said it was action adventure, which it probably is, but it was set in 2094, so that makes it dystopian sci-fi. Yeah. So basically what I tend to do, I'm one of these kind of weird people, and I think you may be the same, that if I'm really inspired by an idea, I'm just going to go with it. I'm going to go with the flow and see what happens. If it doesn't work, it doesn't work, you know? I don't need to show it to anybody. But now I'm good enough to know if it's worked or not. So I don't get my sister going, this is rubbish, the way she did when I was, you know, 13 and wrote really, really, really bad stuff. So I can kind of trust myself now, which is really good.
Yeah, I think it's really, one of the things like, I've talked to a lot of artists is when you start to, you know, get that confidence that, you know, you don't need a producer, that you do know your craft enough that you could self-produce. And I think that's really, really, I think it's a really cool moment when you kind of become like a total, it's like that singer-songwriter thing from the 70s. I was very much like, I love the music. like the Frank Sinatra stuff, the like 50s music where you had a lot of writers and you had vocalists, right?
Yeah.
You had people have like perfect vocals, like really good vocals. And they didn't write. A lot of them, they didn't write their own stuff. Oh, bless you. But it's like when you get to the age of the singer-songwriter, then you got to like, it's like a window into a writer. Like you like a lot of singer-songwriters, like, you know, I think about Dylan. It's like reading really high-end, like, poetry or short stories.
Yeah, well, he actually won the Nobel Literature. That's how good his lyrics were. His lyrics were just amazing.
I love that when he came on the scene, it changed Columbia. Because they had like the Sinatras, they had these really perfect pitch. And then he got Dylan comes in, and he's got this nasal kind of strange sound, but the lyrics are so deep, they had to deal with them.
And then don't forget the music. The music was so deep, they had to deal with it. So it was a perfect marriage of his lyrics and his music.
It was a combination of Americana and folk and electric. And when he started playing with the band, it just opened up like to all the singer-songwriters in the 70s. It just created like where we are today, where people can feel they can come at things. And it doesn't have to be one type of topic. It can be all over the map. And I just thought that freed up a lot of people. I mean, like, people talk about the Beatles. I always bring up Dylan at the same level as the Beatles because it really caused people to create bands.
And the Rolling Stones.
Yeah, and even Lou Reed. Lou Reed's the other one I always try to mention because he's another poet like Dylan. He's like the Velvets and Lou Reed. They used to inspire me, like the whole alternative indie rock scene from the Pearl Jam to the Nirvanas. They're all like name check Lou Reed. Like every time you read about him, that's what they talk about. So, and he was, if you listen, look at his work, it's like it's Dylan like because it's poetry.
It is. The words are amazing.
Read his songs at an open mic. And it's like a poem, because it is a poem. It's not like it is a poem, but I've been very much inspired by that level of writing, which I sometimes find disappointing today because we're kind of hook-driven today in the music industry. It's all kind of beat-driven. I understand that people like that, you know, that type of music, but it just seems like the structure of the old songs, the intros and the outros and the different feels, people have like forgotten about classic structure. I mean, I go back and listen to something from the Carpenters and just like an example, like you listen to like Close to You, like that's a song structure. How many songs
in the top 20? I still remember going crazy for Close to You, and I drove my family crazy singing it.
Yeah. I just get a sound changing in my mind. Like whenever I hear the Carpenters, it brings me back to like 74, 73. I imagine myself in that time period. And it just triggers like a film in my head. And I've always been into the idea of sound paintings. And being, I guess, playing the classical music, it does, like when you play it, do you imagine like a sound painting when you play those pieces? Do you kind of feel that it's setting like a visual kind of synesthesia type of thing? I just feel
it's
like
really,
that.
It's really interesting. You should say that. I've actually got a friend who is a composer, and she does paintings to go with every composition. They're rather abstract, but the colors are really interesting to her because she visualizes colors as being notes and as being keys. I don't get into that at all. But what I do, I'm playing the Elgar. As I mentioned, the Elgar is very amazing cello concerto. It's seen very often as being very sad. But in fact, what Elgar did with it was almost every bar he did something different. So there'd be a wistful bit, and then there'd be something almost mischievous, and then there'd be something very deep. And that's why I think it's such an amazing cello concerto. And being me, I make up stories. So every movement has a different story. It's like a short story, like four different stories. Mm-hmm. So rather than doing what you're doing, which is more artistic, you can see why your daughter is an artist. I don't think like an artist. I think like a writer.
Well, I think that is a good way to be, because it kind of goes back to the idea of like Dylan and Lou Reed, you and Springsteen, to get these guys. And then I lately have been very much into female singer-songwriters like Liz Phair and a lot of the Riot Girl kind of girly sound. It's like with a lot of like Liz Phair was at the big she had this album called Exile in Guyville, which was kind of like a rewrite in her vision of Exile on Main Street from a female perspective. And in the US
I prefer male voices. I find them much more like a cello, really. I prefer male voices to female voices on the whole. I would rather hear like Lee Reed.
Yeah, I can understand that because there's a kind of deepness. Some people like, because I played with my voice, with my Josephine Electric voice, and initially I got a lot of attention just because I was doing something very different. But when I switched back to my male voice, my numbers went higher.
Really? Isn't that interesting? Yeah, I get that.
But lately,
I'm very partial to low tones.
Low tones? Yeah. One of the things, I guess I just got interested in the topics that some of these female singer-songwriters were writing about, because like PJ Harvey and the Liz Phairs, I just thought they were doing more interesting work, at least as an artist to me. So part of my podcast initially is I focused like 70% on female singer-songwriters, because I felt like they weren't being paid attention to. So that's why I started to focus on that, just because it was an area that I thought I could get some ground, gain some ground in it, and it has worked up to this day. But yeah, I am bringing more overall all artists, male or female, all over the world. But yeah, the visual thing, I really was into the sound painting concept ever since I heard like Jimi Hendrix talk about Electric Lady. And somebody asked him, like, "What? I hear birds, I hear ocean." I was like, what is that? And he said, "What's a sound painting?" And I heard George Martin said the same thing about Sgt. Pepper's and Rubber Soul and Abbey Road. He was interviewed and he said, "Well, I could have recorded the Beatles like a bar band. I could have recorded them like they sound in Hamburg." But I said, "Well, why don't I actually make them sound beyond what that could be? Think about like Monet. And like, I could actually have an impressionist point of view using this studio." And that kind of changed music. The idea that, and he actually went on to say that he had been doing Peter Sellers comedy albums. And those comedy albums had backing tracks. They had backward tape loops. They had orchestras. They had sound effects. And the Beatles actually liked George Martin's work on that stuff. And they actually knew about each other. And so then, there was this whole interview that Martin had where he said, like, "Oh, well, the lads decided they like my Sellers work. And I said, why can't we do that with a rock band? Why can't we take some of that stuff we were doing, all these effects and all these layers, and actually apply them?" And that's when you get like start to get Rubber Soul and Sgt. Pepper's. And it really, radically shifted what you could do, because you could go and do a studio record. It has nothing to do with what you could do live. It's actually like it's like a perfection. It's like something you can't replicate necessarily live. It becomes its own thing. And then you have like your live version of the song and your studio version of the song.
Yes.
So do you find, if you ever do you read your books out? Do you do audio books, or do you do performances with your work at all?
I have an audio book of Susan. This one's got an audio book. The other one hasn't yet. I didn't do it. I paid a fantastic actor to do it. What I do feel is, well, I just have to tell you one thing first. One of the biggest thrills of my entire life, two biggest thrills. One was when I played in Carnegie Hall. I played in Carnegie Hall with an orchestra, and I was just going, I cannot believe this is happening to me, because I never thought it would. But the other one was, and I actually burst into tears, was when I was in Abbey Road, and I was there again with an orchestra. I wasn't doing a solo or anything. There were about four cellos. But I couldn't believe I was in Abbey Road Studios. Mm. I was just going, I was just flooded with tears. I could not believe that in this iconic studio, it was just me with my cello. And I just thought, I can't believe that I've actually come this far and done okay. And it was just an amazing moment for me.
Yeah, that's
because of all those amazing albums that were done there. And it just blew my tiny mind, really.
Yeah, if you're able to be like, I've always tracked like places like that, like a Sound City, Olympia Studios, Electric Lady, if you can actually get to that studio and you're like, I'm a big Hendrix guy, like to be at Electric Lady, it is like the dream of any Hendrix fan.
I know, exactly.
Because that meant so much to him. He was spending like his whole last parts of his life actually funding building that studio by like touring really crazy. And
I didn't know that.
Yeah, he actually purposely built that studio because he was such an experimental artist. he had like maxed out how many tracks he could do with the tech at the time, and he wanted to build like a 24 track modern studio to match what his imagination was, because he would be, well, he'd jump on a harpsichord, he'd jump on basses, he'd jump under, if he didn't hear what he wanted, he would try to find a way to get to it. And he would have guys build pedals for him and tell them what he wanted. So he's very, very expansive in terms of his work. He's moving into jazz near the end of his life, working with fusion artists. And he had a very expansive mindset. So he felt like these studios can't do what I want them to do. So he started to build Electric Lady to actually do what he wanted, which I think is so dynamic. And some people have missed that about him. They didn't capture that. That's how. They always just a hippie. Like, he was very much into the details of his music. He used to jump on the boards and say, hey, you're not capturing this right.
I so admire people like that, because I mean, I'm confident on the cello, but I wouldn't be confident enough to jump on a harpsichord. You know what I mean? That's just such confidence.
He just, when it came to music, he had like that extreme ability to like, I know what I want. You know, and I always respect the people like that, from like Stevie Wonder, who will jump on a drum set if he wants to show somebody like what he really wants, and he can do it. You know, Prince was like that too. Like, and Todd Rundgren, I was always into the multi-instrument, the person that can play many instruments. And
I admire them hugely. It's like what we were saying about people who can speak multiple languages. I often say I'm bilingual. I speak English and American.
Yeah, it's very different. I did realize that when I was in Japan. I met some people from London and Australia. And Australian people I met, I was like, wow, that is a totally different version of English.
That's
like, it was different than the UK, it was different than US, and even the Canadians I met had a slight difference. And so I said, well, there's all these variations of English, you know. And I met somebody from, like, my wife is from Barbados, and you know, her version of English is like, is not the same.
No?
You know, Barbadian is very
different. If you think about America, America is so diverse. I mean, my grandmother was from the Deep South. One of my grandmothers. And she used to talk like this. She could talk like this all day long. and I used to love that. It was just so different. But, and then you can have a New York accent. I mean, there's so many different Americans.
Yeah, my mom's from Morgantown, West Virginia. She's a real coal miner's daughter. My grandpa was a coal miner.
No,
he was a farmer, and he built his own house, because the coal miners had this kind of thing where they had to learn how to be electricians, carpenters, plumbers. And so he's like, whoa, I can take all this stuff. He built his own house, you know, and he was a farmer. And my mom had this very kind of self-reliant, like West Virginian type of attitude. And in that kind of West Virginian, like, you know, Blue Ridge Mountain accent.
Yeah.
With kind of like a hillbilly accent. So it's, my dad was from like from Springfield, Maine.
Super so colorful.
His father was like in a Negro baseball league. And so when they got together, had this totally different, you know, and it was cool. Like every summer I got to spend like 2 months in West Virginia and get to know my cousins who are like all, you know, black hillbillies. And like, if you're from the Northeast, you would have never imagined have like African-American hillbillies.
you can get anything. That's how diverse it is. But I kind of empathize with that, because when we came back from Asia, whenever we were on home leave, we didn't have a house because it was rented out. So we would always go to North Carolina, Flat Rock, Hendersonville, North Carolina, and see our cousins. And it was like the highlight of our year. They all had Southern accents too. And it was just so cool to get with our cousins and to hang out.
Yeah, because my cousins, they could hunt, they could fish.
Yeah,
they knew how to farm, and they were fun. You know, they knew how to hang out in the outdoors. And, you know, they were like outdoors people. And they're like, oh, these guys are like cowboys or something. I was a kid. I'm like, wow, my cousin knows how to do all this stuff. And I'm a city kid, you know, from Massachusetts. I don't know how to do any of that.
I thought you were from New Hampshire.
Well, yeah, I was born in Mass. I live in New Hampshire now. But I was born in Massachusetts, which is, you know, not that far. We're still in the Northeast. But yeah,
I bet you got some cool leaves at the moment.
Yeah. Well, we got the pines. Like New Hampshire is famous for its very tall, tall pine trees. So it's like our forests are primarily pine, but and they're just you know, they're very crazy. They're very high. They're very tall, you know, we had to cut some of them down because if they ever hit the house, they're so tall they can like wipe you out. But but that's a divert into that. But one of the things I was looking at, like, how did it feel when you started to you know, get like a lot of success as an author? Because I know a lot of authors and they're kind of independent, like indie musicians, and they never fully break through. But when you've had some things that actually got optioned out too, right? Mm-hmm. You've gotten
I haven't had a film yet, but I've had two film options, and that is really exciting. The thing is, you've got to keep your head straight and not think, oh, I'm going to be rich and famous, because most film options, all they're doing is they're going to try to see if they can fund it, and if they can't fund it, then they just move on, but they don't want anyone else to be doing it.
So
they option it for a year, and you can't sell it to anybody else for that year, and then they beaver around and try to figure out where they can afford to get an orchestra, if that was an orchestra they wanted. It was going to be a series about an orchestra for the Channel 4 here in Britain, the first one. And I obviously just thought, yes, it's all going to happen. But it didn't happen. So, I mean, basically I got, I think it was £4,000, which is about $5,000, for nothing. I just got it for nothing. And that was nice. But
it's nice to get something.
it still didn't, exactly. It still didn't change my life, because it still didn't. And now if somebody says to me on Facebook, oh, I just got an option on my book, I go, don't get too excited. I really hope it happens for you. But, you know, just, you know, keep the lid on, because I was young then. When it happened, I was really young. So I don't know. I think, it's exciting. And when you win a prize, it's exciting. Mm-hmm. And I had a play put on in London. That was exciting. I wrote a play about a conductor. I never thought it would actually be put on. Well, it wasn't put on in the West End, but it was still put on in London. And that was just the thrill of looking down and seeing actors speaking. That was just a thrill. So, yes, I mean, there are things. But I think my big problem and why I'm never likely to be famous is because I'm not single-minded enough. So what I do is, yes, I've decided I'm leaving the Elgar out of it. I've decided I'm really an author now, and the cello is second. But I've written in three different genres. Now that's really dumb. So all you guys out there who are thinking about writing a book, don't be like me. Listen to me, don't be like me. Pick a genre and stick to it. The best one in terms of sales is probably romance. After romance, probably mysteries sell really well. After that, you come to the sci-fi, the historical fiction, we do pretty well. And then, you know, if you write sort of poems and stuff, well, you'll starve. But anyway, but basically, I think I haven't stuck to just one thing. I have sort of now, maybe, but I've taken a long time at it. And so that's why it's hard. What people really want is something they can sell, like, this is this person, this is what she does, this is what he does. Mm-hmm. A sort of brand. My brand is kind of all over the place. And that's probably why the film option didn't work.
Right, they're looking to build, like, I found, like, in even for me, they're trying to find your core audience.
That's it, yeah.
And then they're probably like, I'm a, like, what I call expansive sound, right? So what's that mean? So I run into a PR guy, and I say, what's that mean? Well, because they want to put me into EDM, they want to put me into trance, they want me to put me into trap. And I was like, well, I'm more like a progressive rock band, like Yes, or Genesis, or Funkadelic. And that means I'm kind of crossing genre. And, you know, there was a time when that was okay. But now they want to be so segmented.
To be specific, because it makes it easier to sell. You're a bit like me. If you're cross-genre, and I have a lot of really talented writing friends and musician friends who are cross-genre, that does make it harder to sell. But again, if you have your own brand, you've got your own show, you know, it should be possible. Because you have dedicated yourself to this, you know, and you haven't sort of drifted off and done classical, for example. Do you see what I mean? You haven't gone quite to that. But I think that with writing especially, people want to know where you are. People will say, right, so you're historical fiction. I said, well, yeah, but I wrote this speculative thriller. They're going, you wrote what? and I think that is a drawback. So, you know, again, if anybody's listening, they're thinking, I want to write. Well, pick a genre and really dedicate yourself to making your brand that genre. That's the easiest way.
Yeah, like a Stephen King, horror.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah.
Horror. It's only horror. Though sometimes this horror goes sci-fi. But
yes, it does a bit. I was about to say it's a little more than that. But the other thing about Stephen King is he's made a lot of money telling people how to write, because he understands the actual mechanics of writing, he's also drifted into that. But I mean, we can't compare ourselves to Stephen King because
we're just looking at somebody who's like, you know, like if you get into music,
that's right,
like you look at like, you know, Taylor Swift, you look at like Bruce Springsteen, they kind of stay. But even Springsteen has kind of shifted. You know, he has his solo work where he can be more experimental, and then his E Street Band work that's kind of like, so a lot of us will try to give themselves, okay, my solo album will be.
I think it's something you have to earn, to be honest. I think that once Stephen King was super successful, then he could write a book about writing, and it would be super successful too. But you've kind of got to build patiently up to that point. And so that, again, if anybody's looking for some advice, I would say that. I always say that.
Yeah, you build your fan base. Yeah, building that fan base is real important. And the one thing I found is like the podcasting, it was better for me than like all these people were telling, oh, you pay for all this like SEO. And I understand you need to do that, but like there's a lot of stuff that would end up being like bots. And I'm like, well, to me, what I found, if I do this whole different leg as a podcaster, it increases my people coming into my music. So I actually get really good numbers when I do this. So it's kind of like, well how are you you're taking away from your recording time? And I'm like, no, it actually meeting people and talking to people gives me like a wider audience, gives me more people I could connect with. And it actually helps. Because sometimes, like, just being focused on writing music all day without having other things, I found it this actually is a
it's too much. And also, if you're a people person, and you and I are both people persons, then, I mean, it's great to be on your own and just writing, but not for a whole day. You want to encounter other people. That's why I play tennis so much. I just love tennis. But the thing is that it's you meet different people, and then, you know, you make new connections. And apparently podcasting is just where it's at now. I mean, everybody says, oh, you should have your own podcast. I'm going, no way. But you do it really well. So just carry on doing it, you know.
Is this something that I kind of fell into? Because like somebody found my SoundCloud, and then they said, I'll interview you. And I said, what is that? And they told me they have a podcast. And it was 2016. And I'm like, I didn't know what it was. And really? I thought, oh, it was like, yeah. So this guy in New York, and he named Rocktoons. He was like a DJ. And he found my SoundCloud, and he said, hey, you got a lot of interesting songs here. So he ended up talking to me for like 5 episodes. And then I said, why don't I do the same thing? And I went to my Instagram, and I noticed there was a lot of other artists that were like digging my work. Yeah. And then I just came up with a pitch, and I said, hey, I can put you on a podcast and do a behind the music thing. And I wrote this pitch, and I kept it, and I kept on refining it, and I just had it. And anytime somebody came to me and said they liked a post that I put on Instagram, I would come back to them and say, hey, you want to be on my podcast? And come to find out, like, you know, if I did 10 of those, maybe 2 people would come back and say yes. And then I end up getting like 4 guests a month. And now I get like 12 guests a month. But it's like, it was just a way, and I was able to get, I didn't have to talk to managers. I didn't have to talk to agents. I was talking directly to these artists. And then I found like, well, that's really cool, because I don't have to deal with the middle person. And that's what I've been doing since 2016. I just came up with a way of doing it. And I stuck with it and refined it.
I don't think I'd have heard of a podcast in 2016 either. They sort of came through 2018, 2019. People started talking podcasts.
Yeah, I was on the audio ones. I was on these audio ones that were just on the cell phone.
Yeah, wow.
And I kind of was at the beginning. And then I realized that, well, I can't just do it on the cell phone. I need to add a mic and a mixer. And I started bringing in stuff for my music career and say, yeah, well, if I use a better mic and I use a mixer. If I use these better cameras. And I just started taking the things I knew as a musician and incorporating them in to make it better. But yeah, it become a really cool place that, you know, I there's authors, there's business people. I've talked to actors, film directors. And initially I was very narrow. I'm only going to talk to musicians. And then I said, well, no, I got to open it up because the way the industry now is in podcasting, it's more about entertainment or like overall topics that can cross. I've talked to shamans. I've talked to
the one I heard you, I was just going to dip into it, but it was so good. It was a woman energy healer, and she was a shaman as well. And you got talking about your Buddhism, you got talking about, you know, what you believed in. She was amazing. You were amazing. I thought, this guy's great, you know. So, you know, that if you hadn't opened up, you wouldn't have done that with her, would you?
So. Yeah. Yeah, I started to realize, because, I mean, the
I heard the whole thing. I didn't turn it off. I heard the whole thing, and I thought, whoa, you know?
Yeah, the weird thing, I mean, like, when we first started in podcasting, everybody was like music. They were very narrow. They were like, this is a podcast for men. This is a podcast for women. This is only for writers. This is only for, and then suddenly in the last year or two, things have opened up where, you know, podcasters that were very narrow have opened up to this more wide topic capability and to have different guests. So it's just opened up with all kinds of tools, all kinds of platforms.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, it's more advantageous. Like, our royalty rates are higher. Like, and I always get sad about that as a musician, because I'm a musician. And if I'm on Spotify, my royalty rate on Spotify as a podcaster is higher than my rate as a musician. And I'm like, why is that? And I say, okay, I deal with it, but I don't think it's right.
No.
Because, you know, a musician is, you know, why did they make the choice that's more valuable that you get paid?
Well, don't despair. It could still switch around. What I feel is that it sounds to me as if you sort of made the breakthrough as a podcaster, and as a musician you're still kind of knocking on the door. That doesn't mean it's not going to happen. You sound like a really interesting musician to me, somebody who's really a bit unusual. That can take longer.
Is that the industry, ever since they switched to streaming, the rates have dropped like exponentially. Like if you're on iTunes, dollar, you get 80 cents on the dollar. As a streamer now, you get 0.006 of a penny.
It's unbelievable.
And then, like, a podcast rate could be $17 per 1,000 episodes, which is way higher than what you get as a musician. And unless you're like the Taylor Swift of the world, you get a higher piece of that, but they still are not getting as much. You know,
it's no, as they used to. I think that's right.
Yeah, it's still way lower than what you get if somebody actually buys your record on iTunes or at the store. Yeah. So the streaming is kind of like allows worldwide attention. You can, it's kind of like the radio. It can get you booked so you can do the tour. And the tour will get you the money.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. And then your
I used to tour with orchestras. I mean, it just blew my mind. That was how they could afford to play in London, was because we go to Japan, or we would go to the West Coast of America, and then we'd be able to come back and play in London. London was the expensive one.
That's interesting. We can make more money selling a t-shirt. Like, you know, sell this shirt for like $30. You know, it's my daughter did the logo.
That's lovely.
And the thing is, in music, there's a hoodie. I can sell this for like almost $50. There's a hoodie version. The t-shirt's like $25. My music will make 0.06 of a penny. But my shirt will make like $30, $40, $50. But that's the nature of the business today.
Merchandise is big everywhere. I saw a breakdown. I think I told you I'm keen on tennis. I saw a breakdown of who was it? Let me get this right. It was either Federer or Nadal. I think it was Federer. He's got his own brand of clothes, and they're really nice. They look great. You look really great in them. All guys look really great in them. But they are incredibly expensive.
Yeah.
And that's why he's actually the richest sportsman in the world. He's richer than the boxers. He's richer than the football players. And it's, you know, it's all merchandise.
Well, he figured it out. He figured out what the rock stars figured out. Like, they started to realize that the record companies weren't giving them a cut. And now the record companies, they're trying to get into the merch. So if they sign a new artist, they try to trick them into saying, oh, I get 50% of your merch. And you're like, that's a bad deal. Like, because the merch, usually for an independent artist, you're getting 80-90% of your merch. You should never sign
anything. People are afraid. They're afraid to say no. And I get this. I mean, when I was first looking for an agent, I would have simply crawled on, I would have crawled across coals to get an agent for my books. And whatever deal they'd offer me, it would have been rubbish. Now, as it happened, the agent I got was very ethical, and I got a good deal. But I know people who've been stitched up by agents, because people are so desperate. They really, really want the deal. They really, really want to be published, or they really, really want the breakthrough on their music, and it's hard.
Yeah, I mean, I heard the Beatles, like Brian Epstein, gave them a terrible merch deal. like if you go and read their history, when they were doing Help and all those movies and stuff, their merchandising deal was like pennies.
I'm sure it was.
And Brian Epstein was so embarrassed about it, he tried to hide it from them. He tried to hide that their merch deal was so bad, but they had so many fans that even though their rate was so low, they still made a lot of money. So
they were really poor as well. They were poor Liverpool kids. I'm getting lots of money. They didn't realize they should have got loads more money.
They didn't realize how much more they could have got. And then they eventually renegotiated and they were like, wow, we really got ripped on that one. It did. Even the Beatles, they got hit. So you always have to be mindful when you're an artist. I always tell the young people coming in, like, you got to try to own your master. Keep a high percentage of your merch. Make sure you keep your writing credit. Don't just sell it off to somebody, because that's where your money, when you get older, you're going to want that. You're going to want your writing credit and your master and all that, publishing rights and your performance rights.
Well, there's something also to be said for having what you said earlier about having the say-so, because when I was with Orion, the second book that I wrote, which is not available at the moment, I need to re-edit it and reissue it. It was called Ghost Music. And there's a beautiful cover of the hardback. It was just absolutely stunning. I loved it. I was a cellist, a blonde cellist, incredibly beautiful, playing the cello. And at the backdrop was a Greek landscape at night. Wow. Just absolutely stunning. I said, I just absolutely love this cover. Anyway, so what did they do to the paperback? They put a really stupid cover, still with the cellist, she was the main character, holding a cello, but she was just walking over Waterloo Bridge holding her cello with a raincoat on. And it just wasn't the same vibe. And I just said, can we just use the same cover? Can we just keep the cover? Because it's all really well, for hardback, it's all really well. And and they said, no, you don't know anything about it, just go away. and that's what I don't have to do now that, I'm self-publishing it. I can choose my own artist, and if I don't like the cover, I can commission another one, and that is a really good feeling.
I think that's the big thing, the difference. Like, I went with a label, and I knew, like, all my own music today, I do all my own covers, or I have my daughter work with me, or I have this artist.
I was about to say, your daughter should do it. She's an artist.
Yeah, she does a lot of the stuff. I do some stuff too, because they usually work with a combination of me working with my daughter. I went with this label in New York, and they were like, oh, they rejected my daughter's work. And they went with something that they decided. And it was, my daughter looked at it and said, that's terrible. And it's like, they think this is going to work. And it didn't work as well as the stuff my daughter does. You guys think you know what you're doing.
Well, I think sometimes they do know what they're doing, and sometimes they're right, and sometimes they're just dead wrong. And I do think that they ought to pay more attention to the artist in question. I really do. But anyway, hopefully they will the next time, if you still got that situation going. But it sounds like you're doing really gifted.
She's working on a lot of cool stuff. She's got like a manga and an anime she's developed since being in Japan. She's created like a bunch of original characters, and is into the long form kind of graphic novel. And so she's actually gotten like 3 or 4 different characters that she's built like whole worlds around. And detailed. She takes a lot of years to do character development, like world development. So she designs like the world they're going to be in.
It's called world building. We do it in sci-fi, and world building is mega.
Yeah, it's a lot of work. She's and then she starts to build all the storylines for like an arc, or like 10-issue arc or 12-issue arc. And she's gotten really, really good at like, a lot of people look at her work and they can see like similarities to Steve Ditko, Paul Pope, Jack Kirby, a lot of interesting, famous people. And some
she's only 23, so she's got a whole life ahead of her.
Yeah, she's been doing art. She actually was going to art classes at age like 9. We saw that she had ability, and we sent her to classes. And she went to human figure at age 12, and we had to give her authorization to be, there.
I bet.
With the nude model.
Wow, life model at 12. That's amazing.
And she was able to get into it, because it's like, oh, what are you doing? And it's like, she wants to learn how to do the fingers and the body structure, and you can't do that without actually seeing real people. That's required. And it has nothing to do with whatever you think it has to do with it. Like, no, she's an artist.
It doesn't know you've got to have it. I never understand how they can stay so still. I've got a friend who does it in real time on Facebook. He's very good. You go to these classes, and then you'll be able to watch him, and he sped it up a bit, you know, of what he's done. And it is astonishing.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I was always amazed that she just has it. You know, it's like I kind of had my music. My wife is into like theater, and that's a question. Like when you do your theater, when you did your play, poetry is different than prose, and playwriting is different. Like it's like screenwriting for film and TV. Yeah. How did you get into that? Do you had a love of theater that you kind of
that's the main thing that I would miss if we moved away from London. London's got pretty busy since we moved here over 30 years ago. And sometimes I think I'd rather sort of go live in the country, which is more sort of Jane Austen-y, more green, and not so busy. And then I think, no, because the one thing that we do, or we did, we don't do it so much now because of COVID, but we still do, is the theater. The theater in London is like, well, it's like Broadway. There's no other place except Broadway that's got it.
Well, so in Europe, you're still like London is the best theater scene compared to...
London ties with New York. I'm American born, so I'm still going to say it ties. But something like the Royal Shakespeare Company is just amazing. And yeah, so I mean, it's always sort of been in my head that I could write a play. But I was actually commissioned. A friend of mine who read my first novel said, I'd love you to write me a play as a sort of vehicle. It's not a one-man play, but it was a two-hander. So the woman actor had to play three different parts, and he was throughout. He was just the same. He was the conductor. So anyway, I was commissioned, and he actually paid me for it. And I was going, yeah! And I never thought he'd get it put on, but he got it put on, and that was just through a connection. And it was brilliant. You know, it actually had a three-week run at the Lewisham Theatre, and it was part of one of the best things ever happened to me. So yes, I mean, I haven't been marketing it. I mean, I suppose what I could do is send it to people and say, would you like this to be a vehicle for you? Because, but I haven't done that. And instead, at the moment, I'm just trying to be, as I said, I'm trying to be more single-minded. I'm trying to just really focus on the thing that's really working for me at the moment.
So, yeah, so it's like you kind of...
I'm trying to be more focused.
One question I had though, like when you go from a play to like a teleplay, have you ever thought of doing screenplays or teleplays?
It's really hard to get people to take on a screenplay. I have a friend who has had several screenplays accepted. He lives in Arizona. There's more chance in America because there's just more companies.
More work,
but I think you kind of have to have an in. The other way which you can get an in is if your book is really successful. Then they can say, would you like to be involved in the screenplay if it sells, if the option is taken up? Mm-hmm. That would be like my ultimate ambition, really, would be to have a voice in it, but to have somebody who's skilled in that, who's trained in that. But yeah, I would like
to. Because the teleplay format, I've talked to other writers before, they say it's like it's really different than a novel.
And it is. And the other thing is that they're often written by committee. So sometimes, you know, you get people saying, oh, I don't like that line. And then somebody else will pop in and say, well, why don't we try this instead? And I don't know whether I could actually do that. I could collaborate with one person, but not with like a whole committee.
Whole team.
And some of these movies, they don't work for that reason, I think. There are too many voices, too many cooks are spoiling the broth.
Yeah, I think they went away from the Orson Welles idea.
Yes, exactly.
Because I think, like, if you watch the classic, like, I'm a big Orson Welles, and I just, like, can you imagine a committee trying to do Citizen Kane?
I cannot. No, that's...
I don't think that would happen. that's a pretty, pretty dog.
He's a lovely dog, my little friend. And the reason why he's jumped up on me is because it's now time for me to feed him. So,
we're at the hour mark, so if he needs to eat or she needs to eat, I understand.
Isn't he sweet?
So thank you very much for being on the program. Everybody,
go. I absolutely loved it. Thank you so much for asking me.
To your website, we have up on there, Alice McVeigh. And we want everybody to make sure that you do click the URLs that we do have when we're a podcaster, because then you can check out in more depth the people we interview. As I said, this will be on Spotify video podcast later today and Apple audio podcast, so you'll be able to hear it there, and it'll be on multiple platforms off of Anchor, which means
let's keep in touch, because I really love talking to you.
Oh, thank you. We like to have follow-up interviews. If you have another project in the future you want to push and talk about,
that's really kind. Thanks. Muffet. I can't actually hear you now. I think something's going to take care.